This is Danny Schechter, your news dissector, back in action, back in the U.S. of A., back, or the USSA, however you might want to describe it, back from a month in South Africa and Tanzania, and now I'm here, and the day I arrived, a few minutes later, I got on the train to come back to New York, and there was the news that Bradley Manning had been convicted. Although in most of our media, Bradley Manning was in fact acquitted of a bogus charge, which was thrown in at the last minute so that the judge can appear to be extremely wise and neutral and fair and all the rest of it. We're going to hear more about the case today. Joining me again, Pilar Govin, a musician, my friend, and also the co-host of the show.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good night.
How have you been here in New York? I understand I'm fortunate to have missed 30 days of 100-degree weather or something like that.
I can report that it was hot. But the interesting thing was that that in the 99-mile march that we in the Gitarmi somehow pulled off a year earlier, it was actually 15 degrees cooler than it was on the first 3 days of that goddamn march.
Well, yeah. At least we're back. We're in action again here on News Dissector Radio. This is an extension of NewsDissector.net, our daily blog. Commenting on the news, offering an analysis of what's going on in the world, and that's what I do. I also edit MediaChannel.org, which is back online, so please check it out. We're going to start talking now about this Bradley Manning case, the decision, the implications of it for America and for the world. Of course, today we've learned that Ed Snowden has managed to get out of Terminal 2 in Russia, where he was living in the duty-free area, basically, in the shopping area, and has now been allowed to stay in Russia for at least a year. And former USSR, the president there, Mr. Putin, said, "We never extradite people," and he didn't do it in this case, even though he came under tremendous pressure to do it. I read this essay on NakedCapitalism.com about how Obama has been going crazy, trying desperately to use every technique that he could to get the Russians to turn over Snowden, and has lost at every turn. So Snowden has walked free, or at least free for the next year, to live in Russia. Where he goes from here, what he does next, we don't know. It's a big question, but it's also satisfying that this came the day after the Manning verdict. Joining me to discuss the Manning verdict in a minute, Deborah Sweet, who has been the executive director of the World Can't Wait, a movement that's been fighting for Manning's release and has been doing a lot of organizing and has just been come back from Fort Meade, and so has Kat Waters, who's been on this program, and she was also in Virginia on Tuesday and can tell us a little bit about the ambiance there and the vibe. But we want to start off with a song, which is
Graham Nash's tribute to Bradley Manning.
So let's hear that, and then let's get into this conversation, which is really important.
I'm alright, locked up in the white room. almost done. Almost done.
So Graham Nash, troubadour of justice, like, you know, when he started playing, I thought back to the song Ohio,
exactly.
Four Dead in Ohio. The man has been out there, out front, talking truth, singing truth for all these years. And the fact that he's written a song for Manning is, you know, a sign of his integrity and his courage and his, you know, perspective in terms of the long run to try to work for change. Change that doesn't happen overnight. It never has. And it's the long run that we really are in right now. And Graham Nash's song is sort of a symbol of that. So, you know, Pilar, you heard the news about Bradley Manning. What was your initial thought? No surprise.
No, it was no surprise. And it's really sad that there's no rational point between what any reasonable government has to ban. I mean, you know, when it comes down to it, there is a thing called national security, and you can't just allow, state secrets to be released to the public, particularly when it can endanger people. You know, I mean, you can't stop
that. But
that
wasn't the case here.
Of course it wasn't the case here. But the point is that they weren't capable or weren't interested in finding some kind of rational point between real national security and having to deal with the consequences of their lack of transparency.
Well, we live in the United States of paranoia, Deborah, as you know, and you've been part of this campaign. This must have been, even though everyone expected it in a way, who has been following, you know, the environment in that court and military justice, which has been compared to military music, you know, as being...
Or military intelligence.
But nevertheless, it must have been crushing to be there and look at that young man and see what went down. Describe that scene for us.
Well, you know, Bradley sits in the courtroom and has to face forward towards the judge. He is not allowed by order to make any contact with the supporters, no eye contact. He can't react to anything that's said. So it's as if he's imprisoned. He can talk to his attorneys, and that is about it. So it was very hard to discern any reaction from him, although reporters who are at a remote location and are seeing his face said he showed a faint smile when the first verdict was given, which was not guilty on aiding the enemy, and is the charge which carries the death penalty or life in prison. And, of course, we were relieved. But then there was a string of guilty, 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 guilty 19 times. He was found guilty of being a spy. 5 or 6 charges of violating the Espionage Act. This is totally outrageous.
You know, it's very interesting because when you go back to the history of the Espionage Act, which was passed before World War I, it was followed by the so-called Red Scare. It was followed by the deportation of so-called anarchists from the United States and the crackdown, you know, on free expression in this country going back into the 1920s. So it has this nefarious, infamous history, which none of our media really talks about, the background to the Espionage Act and the appropriateness of charging him under the Espionage Act. So, you know, here's somebody who's a whistleblower who, in the course of his, you know, service in Iraq, came across things that he himself was horrified by and felt a duty to share it with the public. And instead, he is being sentenced to potentially how many years in prison?
136 years.
And this is after, you know, the media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, oh, it's great. You know, he's been acquitted of the charge of a life sentence. If you have a life sentence, often you can get out earlier, okay?
Well, not in the military.
Not in the military.
No, he would have had to serve his entire natural life in prison. And it's still not clear that he won't.
So what happens now?
Well, if he lives to be 138, yeah, he'll have a few years.
So what happens now in terms of the trial?
Well, this is a military trial, so yeah. Of course the question of justice is, it's hanging out there, and I do think that the role of supporters and public opinion
is extremely important because that can't be brought in the same way as you can in a criminal civilian trial. But sentencing discussions started immediately on Wednesday. And what we're finding out, the first government witness actually revealed that they can't find anyone in Afghanistan or anyone in the U.S. military who was killed because of what Bradley Manning revealed. The government can't do it. And here they've tried to put him away for life.
Now, Kat, you've been following this case, and then suddenly you found yourself at Fort Meade. What was the vibe like there for you, you know, to go onto this military base while this whole, you know, trial was going on, the Star Chamber procedure?
The very first time you go, you know, it feels, you know, pretty intense. And the first time you lay eyes on Bradley Manning, it's just, it just does strike you when you see this person. And of course, you could just see the back of his head, maybe, you know, the right side of his face, his right ear. I actually sketched him the very first time I was there. And I make attempts to scribble in my notes as best as I can. And after you go a few times, you start to get... I actually was joking with some of the, you know, the soldiers that take you through the security and they look through your bag and all that stuff on Tuesday when we were down there. But when I did hear the judge saying guilty, guilty, guilty just so many times, like one right after the other, I just put my head in my hands. And you know, it's so obvious. It's just ridiculous what is happening. We've had so many discussions. We actually
But they were making an example of him, obviously. And the whole point is to do that on the grounds that somehow that will deter others from following their conscience in military conflicts and share information about crimes. I mean, we know that, for example, in Afghanistan, somebody who was convicted of being involved in a conspiracy that led to the deaths of many Afghan civilians was given 7 months in prison. Now we have this disproportionate sentence. Now, he did cop to some of the charges against him, so they had that to go on, but they certainly have doubled down on it, haven't they, Deborah? And what's your assessment now? I noticed that the Bradley Manning family thanked the supporters, and I thought that was very gutsy of them, because we haven't really heard from them, that they believe that the support that you and others have been organizing is important and has been a sense of some kind of center of morale for people around this issue and the family of Bradley Manning. But what about the movement that you've been part of, and what was the feeling about all this? What do you do now?
Well, we know, you know, many of us have been opposing these illegitimate, immoral, unjust occupations the U.S. has been carrying out for years. We know crimes have been committed. We are angry and outraged that George Bush, Dick Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, this whole crew of people who pulled off what they did to these two countries and to people around the world, walk free and are not only not charged, not found guilty, not even investigated by this current administration, who came in on the basis of being the not George Bush people who are going to bring some measure of hope and change. And that is one of the most revealing things. 7 prosecutions Obama has made of whistleblowers. Previously, in the whole history since 1917, 3 by all the presidents.
What is it, do you think, is Obama, you know, there have been suggestions that the NSA or somebody has something on Obama and therefore, but I don't think that's true. What is your sense of this?
I mean, he signed up to be commander-in-chief of the biggest empire in world history. I think he's down for the whole thing. And he probably, whatever he agrees personally, this is the agenda that they've decided on: extreme repression, not allowing any leaks to come out like this. And if you were, I was in the courtroom the day the prosecutor gave his closing arguments about collateral murder, which was the video of the Apache helicopter attack, which we've been distributing and showing for 3 years now to thousands and thousands of people, but I had no idea how much the government hated it. The prosecutor called it a piece of propaganda, and it's their own video.
Right.
So you get a sense of, wow, they can't even allow a little bit of truth to come out about what they've done.
They're distancing themselves from it. And of course, you know, they did that also with the Abu Ghraib cases in Iraq, the torture committed by American soldiers. There were some trials of some of those people. Most of them got off. Certainly the higher level people were never prosecuted.
Right.
And, you know, there's a whole litany in history of war crimes. It brings me back personally, maybe because of my age and my, you know, the fact that I don't forget these things, you know, to the My Lai massacre in Vietnam and Nixon basically, you know, pardoning the guy.
Lieutenant Calley,
who murdered children, babies. It's upsetting.
I have a question that has come up. We talked about it. This impunity that the government does have, that, you know, after the verdict and we were outside in the parking lot and you were kind of, Deborah was addressing the supporters. And so, I mean, I'm confused. I can't wrap my head around this whole thing because it's just so ridiculous and blatant and obvious that the government can do whatever they want and not be held accountable. I mean,
you think that's true, Pilar?
Well, the government can do whatever it wants to do until there's a critical mass of citizens that say no more. But that's always the case, isn't it? You know, whether it's the government or the mafia or the bully in the schoolyard, the guy, you know, who's got the bludgeon or the gun will get away with whatever he wants to do unless someone else tackles him from behind or has got a bigger gun. Or can, you know, put a bunch of people together and say this ain't happening. But that's just the way, you know, humans in the wild are.
Well,
just like any, you know, mammal in the wild. You know, you do whatever the hell you want to do until enough get together and stop you.
Let me just jump in here on this because we have to look at the implications of this also. What happens now to Assange, for example? It seems as if he is at great risk right now.
Absolutely. In the closing arguments, for instance, the prosecutor in the first hour mentioned Julian Assange and WikiLeaks 10 times. I was sitting next to Michael Ratner, and he's scribbling this down. He represents Julian Assange. And I notice in the Washington Post today, their conclusion is that Julian Assange is now in even greater danger because of these convictions, and I think that's true.
You know, yet at the same time, when the government goes to this extreme of this type of a trial, which everyone who's reported on it, you know, basically questions the fairness of and basically comments on the way journalists have been treated there, the way journalists haven't even covered it in many cases or covered it very superficially, except perhaps the final moments here. There's a sense that the government, there's a desperation here to try to keep the cork in the bottle, to keep doing what they're doing. And every day there seems to be something new coming out. Most recently, these extreme revelations by Glenn Greenwald in The Guardian, which is information provided, I presume, by Snowden, you know, of a new government program is sweeping up information about everyone's private emails and all the rest of it. So what happens now? There seems to be this tit-for-tat battle going on.
I think there is a battle. And finally, it seems like there's a significant number of people waking up, as opposed to several years ago when Obama came in and a lot of people were bamboozled. But what Snowden did, it's quite extraordinary when you think about it. Here's Snowden, who knew what had happened to Manning, and he still comes forward and says this. And then I also agree with you, Danny, about this bottle, because here's Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the U.S., who writes a letter to Putin in Russia. The layers of irony in this, Eric Holder is saying, it's okay, you can let him go. He's he's not going to be subject to torture because torture is not legal in the United States,
right.
And we won't give him the death penalty.
And how do they define torture? They don't define it the same as everybody else defines it either.
That's,
you know, like, yeah, like subjecting people to extreme conditions they don't consider to be torture.
Well, let's kind of look at this terrain, okay? Manning convicted. Snowden released the very next day by Putin. Mm-hmm. The world media, for the most part, critical of the United States. Certainly every international freedom of expression group condemning the United States for this. The House of Representatives stopped on a vote to try to stop some of these practices by just 7 votes, with the White House heavily lobbying against an amendment to a bill, something almost unprecedented in the history of the Congress of the United States. So there's a kind of an extreme game of pressure going on here. Mm-hmm. Now, what can the movement do? Is the conclusion from this that you can't do anything, that no matter what we did and we protested and all the rest of it, they still convicted Bradley Manning, so you might as well roll up your posters and go home? Or is this time to increase the pressure?
I think quite the opposite, because, of course, they have state power, and they're very nasty. This is brutal, what has been done already, torturing Bradley for 10 months, holding him in solitary confinement, as Graham Nash portrays in the song. And I do fear for Bradley. On the other hand, this has now become a question that it's not clear whether the U.S. will succeed in this repression. They certainly want to, but there is a sleeping giant that potentially could be awaked. I know World Can't Wait is distributing this Collateral Murder DVD free to anybody who wants it.
Well, I'll
We're
tell
determined
you,
to have people see
well,
this.
Well, I'll tell you that I showed it at a workshop of some 15 journalists in Africa while Obama was visiting Tanzania. And the people put their hands on their eyes. They couldn't believe this. They'd never seen anything like it before. These are African journalists at a seminar organized at the Zanzibar Film Festival by the Tanzanian Media Fund. And I was doing a workshop on critical journalism.
Good.
And, you know, one of the things we were talking about is why the journalists, or rather the big newspapers in Tanzania, had given Obama such a free ride when, in fact, what he was proposing essentially was a power plan that will just benefit General Electric more than the people of Tanzania. But this collateral video, which they had never seen before, just was a shock to everyone in the room. So
it shocks the conscience.
Yeah, well, it goes against everything that our national myth, you know, goes on about. You know, I think what we're all witnessing is an empire that's starting to understand that it's over. That you know, when you go back and start looking at when the manufacturing base started leaving, and China starts to come up, actually making things, and then 9/11. You know, when you're the empire, when you're the alpha, you know, you can look at the Roman Empire is the cliche. People get comfy. People get lazy. People.
It's time to get on lazy. I mean,
well,
it's just that simple.
But it's not that simple,
yeah,
because
it is.
People
Catherine,
feel entitled. People live a life, almost an entire life, feeling entitled. There's abundance. There's money if you're white. And things are easy. When suddenly things aren't easy anymore, what happens? There's a big flight to fundamentalist religion. You know, my God, a building collapsed. You know, every day in the beginning of World War II, British buildings were collapsing. Somehow they survived. In Israel, buildings collapse all the time, bombs all the time. We lose a building, and the country goes berserk.
It wasn't just about a building, but
something sacred was invaded.
Yeah, but we have Deborah here, who's been a prime organizer in all of this. We have a lot of philosophical feelings about it, but there's a political challenge here, let's put it that way.
Well, there is. There's a basic illegitimacy, I think, a lot of people feel, that Catherine has voiced and many, many other people. How can they get away with this? How can they do this? All the weight of the U.S. on this one guy who was 22 years old when this happened.
It's they're showing what they do. I mean, like,
Catherine, please let me just hear the plan. We have, look at the clock. We have 5 minutes to go. Give me the plan of what you're planning to do, because we want to leave with more than a kind of an analysis here. We want to leave with some sort of plan for action. And then you can comment on it, please.
I think very simply, we have the demand that Bradley Manning not do one more second in jail at the end of this sentencing procedure, which is going to go for several more weeks. We are inviting and asking more people to come down to Fort Meade, Maryland, to be in the court when this sentencing happens, more people to talk about it. We're calling on the media to cover it. And we are distributing and asking people to watch this collateral murder video, which he may end up giving a big portion of his life to have gotten out to people.
Yeah, there has to be a pushback against fear, and I think that's what I was, you know, trying to lay out.
And what about the media here? How would you assess the coverage of the Bradley Manning case?
I mean, 100 of them showed up on Tuesday. Usually there were 8 or 9 through most of the trial. And the main thing that's not been covered, which is just criminal in my opinion, is the underlying reason that Bradley had to do what he did. They're not covering the war crimes. It's as if this is all over. It's history. It's not today's news. Let's forget about it. This is really important that this is all being brought up again. And we have to fight for people to pay attention.
Now, please, your final comment.
That was the bit on the PBS channel. They had a bit, you know, did Bradley Manning get a fair trial?
Mm-hmm.
And they had Michael Ratner debating with this Jeffrey Smith of the CIA. And, I mean, I don't know, to me, it's just clear that these people, their views are just so extreme, and they're just so used to having so much gall and nerve that they don't see anything wrong. And his attitude is the government and military has a right to its secrets, but yet the average person doesn't even have a right to their basic right to privacy. I mean, it's just complete
That's the conflict. We can go on this, I'm sure, but I'm glad we've raised the issues, Deborah.
Yeah.
A lot of respect for the work you've done to try to bring this issue to public attention. How do the people reach you?
WorldCan'tWait.net, and you can call us the old-fashioned way, 866-973-4463.
Thanks so much. Deborah Sweet, Cat Waters, Polar Levine. We'll be coming back and meet Laura Gottsteiner, who's written a fantastic book, A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place Called Home. Stay with us.
Wish you were soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
20 Santa stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Colt, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned baby.
Order now.
For life is pure, the rest is skin and bone, but they all come together in this place that we call home. Hey, yeah. We all agree about that. Home.
why that song? Why did you do that? It's really beautiful.
Yeah, the song came out of that whole foreclosure mess. And what occurred to me, what was just driving me nuts for the years leading up to it, was how people would buy houses and flip them. Mm. You know, they're nothing but property. And, you know, people's homes are not junk that you flip, you know. There's something sacred about it. And when I went back to that old song, it's corny. It's from 1823, but there's something about that. You know, I don't believe in sacredness in religious terms, but there are certain things that somehow are sacred. And home, you know, where the kids come up, and that's the place, and that's the place, you know, that's sacred.
It's also flippable. About the dreams that a lot of Americans have, to have a place to live, to have a roof over their heads.
To have
now,
a
Laura,
home foreclosed on.
Laura Gottsteiner, is that pronounce that right?
Sounds great.
Not bad, huh?
Not bad at all.
Written a marvelous book here, people. A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place Called Home. And it's published by Zuccotti Park Press. Greg Ruggiero, our old friend, has been involved in this. He's told me about you. I've read this book. It's a marvelous account. Now, just for background, you know, I did a film, In Debt We Trust, 2006, talking about subprime lending, talking about the outrage of the frauds that led to the financial collapse, warning of it, predicting it, and finding it very difficult to get people to even pay attention to it, other media people to recognize what was going on, civil rights leaders in America to realize how the black community in this country was about to be devastated and was being devastated. And yet, this went on almost unreported, under the radar, you know, of a lot of blather about the economy and the financial collapse and Bernie Madoff and everything else. But what was happening to people throughout America who had hopes of improving their lives by moving into a better neighborhood or getting a better school for their children were crushed by manipulations by all sorts of financial institutions. You document this. You not only document it, but you tell the story of the people themselves, of individuals. How did you start out to do this, Laura? What was your motivation, and what did you find? Tell me about your process here, because it's a phenomenal effort. And the fact that this is coming out now, so many years later, only means that it's even more important, because most people don't even know this story.
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me on the show. The fact that it's coming out today, which is something I'm sure we're gonna circle back to, definitely made me nervous. You know, does the media, does the press care at all about this crisis? And even though we're seeing a lot of the collateral effects of this crisis continuing, even though the actual numbers of foreclosures have gone down, it's still very much in neighborhoods across the country, particularly in neighborhoods of communities of color. So I'm really honored to be here and have the opportunity to talk to you about this today.
We're going to, in a few minutes, listen to a review of this book by none other than Mumia Abu-Jamal, who recorded a review from prison because he felt that this book is so important and wanted to support it. So I think there are many other people will support this book once they know about it and will read it and find in it a lot of information that they didn't know, even if they are regular avid readers of the New York Times or the Guardian or whatever. Mm. This crisis has been undercover. The human impact of it has not really risen to the level of emotional engagement and protest, because it to me, it's something that, you know, is sort of obvious on one level, but sort of has happened in a way, in almost the sub rosa way. What did you find out when you began looking into it?
Well, I think the underreported aspect of the crisis is what really struck me the more and more I was digging into it. You know, it was plastered, particularly the plummet in home values was plastered all over financial press, all over the New York Times. But the number of people affected was, to me, shockingly a difficult number to find. And when I started to investigate, okay, so more than 4 million homes have been foreclosed on, in which they've had completed foreclosures, meaning the family's out of the house. How many people are we talking about? Oh, that includes apartment buildings with up to 20 or 30 families. So I started to run the numbers. And I found that more than 10 million people have been evicted since 2007 as a result of the foreclosure crisis.
Hold on, hold on. Let's underscore that. 10 million people, okay? We read about, you know, disasters around the world almost every day. Hundreds of people here or a flood. 10 million people's lives have been disrupted. Children have been relocated. Children have been moving in with their relatives, losing their rooms, losing their bedrooms.
And I think the fact that this number, 10 million, is first shocking to people, but also was so difficult to find. I mean, I ran the numbers and I was like, this can't be true. So I checked with my friend at the Fed and I was like, does this feel? And he was like, yeah, that's true. It really underscores the way that we've talked about this crisis. And this refers to the ideological disconnect that you mentioned with the song. There is a intensely competing narrative right now in this country about what the value of a home is. And on the one hand, it evokes songs about, you know, sacredness, refuges. That in and of itself is somewhat of a problematic narrative. It definitely puts a lot of the responsibility on women. But the point is that homes have, throughout much of the course of the United States, been something that you cannot measure the value of because it falls in the bounds of what somebody needs to survive and what a thriving family and then a thriving society needs. Right now, we live in a moment where that's not how we value homes. We value homes. What is the cost of this home? What is the mortgage attached to this home? What is the interest rate? And what financial product have you been sold to acquire this home? And the disconnect, the ideological disconnect between these two narratives is, in large part, what created this crisis.
Now, let me just take a second out here to introduce you, at least from the bio in your book, because I'm like knocked out by how brilliant you are and how incisive your critique is. Laura Gotsdiener, a freelance journalist in New York City. She's written for the Huffington Post, the Arizona Republic, the New Haven Advocate, Alternate, Waging Nonviolence. She was an associate editor. She won the John Hersey Prize at Yale University for a body of journalistic work, was a national finalist for the Norman Mailer Nonfiction Award for her 2009 investigation of girls wrestling. She was actively involved in the Occupy movement, lived in Zuccotti Park from early 19 October 2011 until the police raid in November 2011. This is her first book, A Dream Foreclosed, and a brilliant book it is. I just, in writing this book, I mean, did you at some point find this can't be true because nobody else is writing about it?
You know, I've been working on a piece for the last few weeks that ran today at Tom Dispatch, and I've been really grateful to publish there. It's my first time. And this piece specifically was focusing on the violence, both psychological but also physical violence associated with the foreclosure crisis. And as I was investigating this, researching it, living with families who have endured it, speaking to many people who have endured it, I was completely blown away. I spoke to a housing activist in Chicago who said, when you are foreclosed, when the police comes, it's your day of your eviction, and in Chicago, they don't post that ahead of time, so you don't necessarily know that's coming, that it's that day your eviction is coming. They break down the door, and they come in with guns drawn. So we're not talking about, I think there's a conception that the foreclosure crisis has been this passive movement where people leave one home, relocate to possibly a smaller home, and it's not a very big deal. This is a violent dislocation of millions of people out of the communities in which they live and into other communities.
And the level of support for them, the level of recognition of their issues and their problems has been, shall we say, very underdeveloped in many cases. I worked a little bit with the organization NACA, which is the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, which has been organizing around this issue for several years. It's kind of controversial. Some people think that they, you know, kind of are kind of fronting for the banks. Other people see them as a group that has really put the banks up against the wall to try to protect people from being foreclosed upon. But it's clear that this is a tremendous collision that's going on between the values of a people's right to live. The right to a home, it's a human right, is being sort of denied every day in America. And it's everything has been monetized. So people's lives have been monetized.
Well, I think, yeah, the idea that people's lives have been monetized or commodified is something that came back again and again in my conversations with not just activists working on this, but just regular individuals who either have gone through foreclosure, are afraid of going through foreclosure, or merely just live in a community that has been hard hit by it. And what was so exciting to me about working on this project was people, person after person told me, you know, to me, the fact that we value a home for its worth rather than its human value as something that a human being needs to survive embodies not just the commodification of homes, but the mass commodification and privatization that is occurring right now in the United States and that we're exporting all over the world. So to me, the potential in this moment, if more people were to see this as something to rally around and join up in the work that already is happening in communities in an incredible way, would be we wouldn't just challenge, you know, the bank's mortgage policies, but we'd be really challenging the increasing commodification of life itself.
As a journalist, I just also want to give some props here, because there's been a lot of writing about this crisis based on reports, based on quotes from officials of various kinds, maybe even from advocates. But you've actually gone into the homes of people facing displacement, facing eviction, facing foreclosure, and you've lived with them. You've seen what life is like. I think that itself is an important act of not only reporting, but witnessing what was going on.
I appreciate that, although I have to truthfully put the thanks right off of me and onto people, all of the families who opened their homes to me, and there were dozens, if not hundreds, across the country, and also to two networks in particular, the Occupy Homes Network and the Take Back the Land Network, are two national networks of housing activists, and their incredible commitment to helping me uncover this story, to supporting me throughout the reporting process, is the only reason this book exists. That and the generosity of the families who did welcome me into their homes.
You know, I also want to point out, maybe this is inappropriate, you know, but you this is a book about Black America, mm-hmm. written by a white activist.
Yep. It's not inappropriate at all.
Who is not afraid to write about this, because this is a problem for all of us. I wanted to invite now Mumia Abu-Jamal to share his thoughts about this book, which we have the audio of. It hasn't been broadcast anywhere, I've been told. So mm-hmm. this is a exclusive first, along with Laura's first appearance on the radio to talk about her book. I'm sure she'll be getting a lot of visibility and a lot of publicity in the weeks and months ahead. But we're so grateful that you agreed to come and share your story with us. And this is an issue that Polar has written songs about that we care very deeply about. We've been battling to get attention for this issue for years. This is not just ours. Let's hear from Mumia.
American Dreams, American Nightmares, a book review of A Dream Foreclosed by Laura Gottesdiener. Can a book be both beautiful and terrible? Adorning its front cover is a beautiful little girl, her hair neatly sectioned into intricate cornrows, the ends of her braids festooned with bright plastic baubles. But the story within these pages is hardly one of beauty. It is the terrible, heart-rending, soul-eating tale of the foreclosure crisis. How capital waged a war of greed, fraud, and malice to wipe out the wealth, homes, and well-being of millions of people. And yet, Laura Gottesdiener's fine little book, A Dream Foreclosed, manages to find some beauty amidst immense pain and suffering. The beauty of people continuing to fight back against rapacious banks, the politicians they buy, and the lawyers they hire. People fight for years against fraudulent, robo-signed foreclosure notices, court hearings, heavily armed sheriffs and police, and actually win, because they discover that there is power in communities and in movements. They learn that they aren't alone. Indeed, there are millions of people thrown into the horrors of homelessness, suffering in silence and shame. Gottesdiener tells their stories of how they joined or sometimes built movements to change their condition and won. Gottesdiener tells the life tales of four families who, though driven to the brink of madness and despair, find solace in united struggle against monstrous odds. Through movements, through united action, these desperate and scattered families build kernels of community and bonds of solidarity. As Hetty, the mother of one young man facing foreclosure, said, "People in numbers work magic. They receive nothing but scorn and derision from their elected so-called leaders, whether local or national. So pressed against the wall of hopelessness, thrown into the refuse heap of society, they became their own leaders and created social change. A dream foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home by Laura Gottesdiener is a work both beautiful and terrible that deserves to be read by many."
Wow.
From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And you can hear the people.
Oof. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You know, when I worked at WBCN in Boston, where I first met Hilar, we had a show called Lock Up on the air in Boston, which was listened to by every prisoner in Massachusetts and who reported for this program. It was the voice of the imprisoned people, the voiceless people. And, you know, Mumia has carried on that tradition. You could hear in the background, probably in the prison yard, the voices of people as he spoke with so much passion, so much eloquence, and so much support for your book. That must be a very flattering review. I noticed that Naomi Klein has also endorsed this book. But, that's a particularly ringing endorsement in the tones that Mumia is so capable of delivering something in. What do you think when you first heard that?
Well, I think there's something very powerful, so powerful about hearing his voice, because he's such an iconic voice. And when I heard it, and I also heard him say my name and also talk about a project to which I feel very close, obviously, it really made my heart stop. And I think what I appreciated the most was that he started by describing Justice's face and Justice's braids. And she's the young girl who's on the cover of the book, and she's the daughter of Martha Biggs, who is one of the leaders of the Chicago anti-eviction campaign. And when she was homeless with her kids, she actually took over a bank-owned home, rehabbed it, and now her kids live there. And what struck me so much about what Mumia was saying was that her face is so beautiful. And that, truthfully, is what, not just her face, but the people who have been victorious in this struggle is the reason that I pursued this project in the first place. And I think we can often get lost in the numbers about how many people are displaced, how much wealth has been lost, how many laws have been broken. But the point that I really wanted to make with this book is that people have won. And that, to me, is really beautiful and inspiring.
I notice also that Ralph Nader has endorsed the book, calling you the acute eye and pen of a young progressive star with extraordinary talent. Her pages should grip you with motivational indignation.
Yes.
How about that?
Yeah. And, you know, to spread the props around just a little bit, Mr. Schechter, In Debt We Trust, your film, you know, when I was working on the music for that, and I'd hear it over and over and over again, but there's this one segment that you recorded of this woman talking about when this marshal just banged into her home while her kids were eating lunch and kicked them out of that home, and how those kids just had not gotten over it. They just hide under the bed. They're probably freaked out for life.
And traumatic experience.
Unbelievable.
For young kids.
That woman's voice stopped me cold every time. And you must have, Laura, just heard voices like that all the way through your project.
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing. You know, there have been so many studies that show the effect of dislocation and displacement on children's test scores. And nobody cares. Honestly, nobody cares. No matter how many times we say No Child Left Behind, nobody cares. No one's going to halt the foreclosure crisis because kids' test scores are slipping. But the moment that you hear a young girl, you know, because I spent about a week, Martha graciously invited me to stay with her in her home, and I spent about a week with her and her kids, and you hear them recount one of the multiple times that they had been evicted, and clearly these kids have not gotten over it, and it is only due to the incredible mothering of Martha, the support of the community, and frankly, the kids' just incredible intellect that they have kept up in school, and they are thriving, and they are doing well and getting A's.
Yeah. Had their stock portfolio slipped, I'm sure
we would have heard about it. We certainly would have heard about it.
Well, the word indignation, of course, is appropriate, but there's another word we haven't talked about yet, Laura, and you also deal with this in your book, and that is the concept of intentionality, that a lot of the practices you describe were not practices that sort of just happened because bankers, you know, kind of guesstimated or misestimated or made a mistake. This was a plan. In many instances, they were deliberately giving people subprime loans when they would have qualified for prime loans. And they did it deliberately and with malice. In some cases, they've paid, you know, expensive settlements. So you have a figure in here of 10 different settlements, I believe. Mm. Something like, what is that figure? $8 billion?
Oh, many more than that. It's more than $10 billion just for settlements about racially tilted foreclosure practices alone. And then the settlement.
Now, this is where banks actually admitted that they did these things.
Well, I'm sorry. I mean, one of the many problems of the justice system is that we have these no-guilt settlements.
Right.
So actually, many
Forgive
of these.
Forgive me. I didn't mean.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't mean that they admitted it because none of them have been punished for it for the most part. They've been. I think you can count maybe on one or two fingers the number of people who have gone to jail
only for
this kind of abuse.
Trading,
right? Right.
But
absolutely.
Nothing for this.
You know,
type
if
of
you
fraud.
Cheat an investor, then you're bad. But if you cheat a tenant or a poor person, there's no impunity there. And I think your book skillfully interweaves, you know, the world of the bankers, the world of the lenders, the world of the con men and hustlers and criminals who prey on these people with the actual experience of the people themselves who are motivated in most cases because they want something better for their children.
Well, I think, you know, and this is where your work too has been very pioneering. The mainstream narrative about the foreclosure crisis and about the crisis in 2007-2008 has been that there was a mass crisis with no perpetrators. This cataclysmic event occurred, unprecedented essentially in human history, outside, of course, of the Great Depression, happened, and nobody was really to blame, although many things happened. And so one of the goals for me in this project was to name the names of the people that created this crisis, explain how they did so, and explain why they did so. And it's not a very difficult trail to trace. I am not a financial reporter. So the way that we cover these types of crises need to change. We need a mainstream media even that's willing to say when there are victims, when there's a situation that's sad, there is usually somebody who could be held accountable for that problem. And to me, that's actually what makes me most frustrated. It's not like the Times hasn't done, and all of the other mainstream media outlets haven't done, very good reporting about how sad the foreclosure crisis has been. The problem is they haven't adequately placed blame on the people that are to blame.
I think a lot of the journalists go to school with a lot of the bankers. And I think, Janie, you certainly know this. I mean, the journalism is now, you know, a college, a post
upper class thing. It didn't start out that way.
You don't start out in the mailroom
anymore.
It used to be,
you know, guys in the bars that, you know, that working class blokes, as they say, who were reporting on working class issues. That's long gone. We have MBAs reporting on MBAs who basically rationalize and explain them away. And I want to thank you again, Laura. I want to remind people. This book, A Dream Foreclosed, it's coming out today, Black America and the Fight for a Place Called Home. It's a powerful piece of work by a writer who you're going to hear a lot more about. I'm pleased and proud that you chose to come here on our program, even as nervous as you claim to have been before you showed us how skillful and professional you are. You're ready for Fox. You're ready for CNN. You're ready for prime time. But at least here on PRN, we like to try to deal with issues like this. So thank you so much for coming in here and participating. Is there a website for the book?
There is. So you can see the book at Zuccotti Park Press's website. And I also just wanted to give a really quick shout-out to Zuccotti Park Press. It's a new press, only about a year old, although it has already published Chomsky. And I just want to say, and this is why also it was such an honor to be on this show, to be working with reporters who are really committed to these issues, feel these issues, and working with a publishing house that is so committed to revolutionary change, it's been absolutely a pleasure.
Zuccotti Press. ZuccottiParkPress.com is the website. Thank you so much for listening. Again, I'm happy to be back. I've been in South Africa. I'm back here now. You can reach us. You can reach us at dissector@mediachannel.org. Check out the mediachannel.org website. My blog is at newsdissector.net. I write every day. We're on every Thursday at 5 o'clock. And we welcome your input, we welcome your comments, and help us get the word about the show out there. So, and the show, the song rather?
The song is called Plunder, and it was written for your film, Plunder.
Plunder, the crime of our time. Thank you. And thank you, Heather, for being at the board.
Nighty-night, all.